welcome to episode 53 of There Is No Offseason, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus focusing solely on Fantasy Keeper and Dynasty League formats. I am your host, Ben Carsley, and I am joined by BP's fantasy manager and the one person who's sad about Edwin Jackson, Brett Sayer, and my fellow author, fresh off of a failed trade for Matt Collins, it's Craig Goldstein. Say hi to everyone and tell them where they can find you on the interwebs, and Brett, let's start with you.
You can find me at baseballprospectus.com, thedynastyguru.com, and on Twitter at dynastyguru. Greg?
You can find me at Baseball Prospectus, at the Dynasty Guru, at Fox Sports MLB, and on Twitter at CD Goldstein. That's CD as in compulsory detention, Goldstein. Ben?
Fair enough. You can also find me at Baseball Prospectus. You can find me at BP Boston, and you can find me on Twitter at Ben Carsley. You can find this podcast on Twitter via the aptly named at Tino Podcast handle. Like us on Facebook at There Is No Offseason, and you can ask us questions and talk to us about your feelings by emailing us at tinopodcast@gmail.com. So as you have no doubt noticed by now, for you are an astute listener, we are without the services of Mao tonight. But considering we have not recorded since March of 1996, I think, we decided not to wait for Mao and to just push on with the three of us with a shorter episode, but one that is at least timely since we have plenty to talk about in terms of call-ups and trades and whatnot.
Was it March of 96? It was right after the site redesign. That's the only thing I remember.
It was definitely before the Atlanta Olympics.
Okay.
That would make sense. Craig, I believe that's your second dated BP internet joke of the day.
You know, go big or go home.
It's true. Give the people what they want. Okay, so before we get into trades and call-ups and whatnot, let's start off with reader emails. And our first reader email this time is from Kurt. Kurt says, "What's up, Fab Four? I belong to a fifth-year, 12-team Roto Dynasty, 25-man MLB rosters, 15-man farm slots, with 7 original owners. Since the league inception in 2011, we've played under a system wherein owners have 6 years of control over players promoted from their farm, 3 years at $1 each, then 3 years at half their projected auction value, which for a prospect junkie like myself is phenomenal. However, some of the newer blood in the league have expressed the opinion that this is simply too many seasons of control, and it creates a significant initial disadvantage for anybody who inherits a team, as any halfway decent young player doesn't become auction eligible until they're approaching 30, and they're so cheap until then that it becomes an extremely pricey proposition to trade for them prior. So with all that background, my question is this. What are your opinions on the ideal keeper length for prospects? Is 2 to 3 years of control a better idea? Or do you lean the other way toward the keep forever side? Thanks for the 80 grade analysis and podcast, Kurt." So really this, as far as fantasy leagues go, this actually does a pretty good job of simulating, you know, how players are cost controlled in the majors. So I think that's pretty interesting. Craig, do you like this aspect of it? Do you agree with some of his league mates that they shouldn't be under for control as long? What say you?
I guess we've talked about this, like when we've talked about our ideal kind of leagues. My personal preference is to have like keep forever leagues. And so this is the more years of control is fine with me. I also tend not to play auction dynasties. So obviously that kind of does change things in terms of how long you can keep people. This kind of seems to mimic the MLB system in terms of having a extremely low salary for the first 3 years and then kind of arbitration based on how they perform, etc. So I do kind of like this setup. I get the complaint, but at the same time, it's a 12-team league, so it looks like it's not. It's a mixed league. So in my mind, there are enough under-the-radar or pop-up guys in a league that size that you're not, like, desperate for talent. And so I'm fine with this amount of control. Brett, how does it look to you? It doesn't seem like there's any urgency in terms of acquiring talent. Like it shouldn't be locking everyone down given the size of the league.
Yeah, it doesn't say how many keepers this is year to year though, right? Unless I'm missing that in the email. It says the roster size, but it doesn't say.
Dynasty, 25-man MLB rosters, 15 farms. So if it's Dynasty,
you just keep anyone you want, yeah. I assume, yeah. Then, as long as you're under the cap. Yeah, I don't like auction values for wide keeper, for real Dynasty leagues, kind of for this reason. I prefer just to have your standard kind of keep forever format where you don't have costs, you just have players. If you're going to have an auction, I prefer to have sort of a 5 to 10 keeper max. That way, usually sort of that'll sort of weed some of this stuff out. But I guess I don't have an issue with the way that it's done. I think, I think 6 years is fair if you draft a guy on their farm. I just I don't like the jump to half their projected auction value. I think that's I don't like that particularly. And then it just stays there for 3 years.
No, I think
it would change.
The reason
every
I
year.
Thought it was like arbitration was because every year it adjusts to half their projected auction value.
That's
yeah, but
so it's like arbitration.
Yeah, but every year it's half. So it's never if you draft, a guy who is a consistent projected $30 player, then you just get him for $15 each of those last three seasons. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like that. I like the incremental adds better. And honestly, I'd start it in year two. I think 3 years at a dollar is a little obscene as far as cost goes. I think you can jump it up a dollar value. I mean, you can. I know a league where if you for every year that you have a guy on your farm team, you kind of depress the amount that his salary jumps. So it's usually a $5 jump, but if you if you have a guy on your farm team for more than two seasons, you get a $3 jump, and if you have a guy on your farm team for more than three seasons, you get a $2 jump, at least at the beginning. So I mean, having a scaled jump like that could be a way to, I guess, could be a way to give some benefit to teams that draft guys early and have sort of that benefit. But if you're kind of just grabbing a guy who's getting to double A in a farm team for your farm team, and that has less of an opportunity. I mean, this is a 12 team league after all. So, I guess a long way of saying I don't really like the structure.
But do you think shortening it is better?
Shortening the amount of control? No, I think escalating the price is better, because then if you hit on a superstar, then you should be able to keep him for 6 years. If you hit on a guy who, if you hit on a guy who's a $10 player, what do you mean, you can keep him for $5 each of those seasons? That just seems unnecessary. Ben, you have any thoughts?
I was just waiting for more of an involved answer from you. I feel like you sort of half-assed that. Didn't really give it the time it deserves. I don't really care. It's fine. It's a 12-team league. I mean, I get Brett's point, but at the same time, I mean, I think side more with Craig in terms of I'm in favor of formats that just let you keep people forever, and by making it so cheap to keep decent players their last 3 years that you basically are allowing them to keep them forever. So it seems like a roundabout way of accomplishing the main goal of a dynasty league. So I don't really know if you need that system at all, but it's fine. It's okay.
It's also just like, I get that they're whining about not having access, but just do more research and draft better. Like, if you want to be in a dynasty league, don't whine about people who do more work in it.
Well, especially a 12-team, it can't be that hard to find decent players.
Right. I mean, that's what I meant, is that, like, people will bubble up who aren't necessarily on someone's 15-man roster. So it's not.
Yeah.
Okay, these are.
Like, if this was a 20-team league, I'd be a little more at least understanding.
Like TDGX, that would be awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough.
Kind of. I mean, TDGX has its 10-man farm for 20-team league, so it's only like 25 more minor leaguers that are owned.
Yeah, but people... No, that's not true. Many more minor leaguers are owned. They're just not necessarily competitive rosters.
Well, but how do we know that this league is?
Can there really be two Bloomberg Sports that exist out there at the same time?
It's not just them. That's
yeah, there are anyway. Many.
Yeah. I don't know. Tell them to shut up and stop whining is what I would say.
Yes, draft just better.
In general, I think that's solid fantasy advice.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to our second reader email, which is from Ziggs. And we're going to have to sort of run through the list on this one, but just hold on, follow me. Ziggs says, I want to start by saying you guys rock, love the podcast, and it certainly makes my drives to work or any other boring task a lot more enjoyable. My only complaint is that you guys don't do enough pods. That's pretty fair. My question is about the arrival dates of several of the remaining top flight prospects. While I know this can be a rather tricky venture, it is one of the most valuable tools for players in Dynasty Leagues. I play in an, I can't say that, it's Odonuo? I don't know how to pronounce it.
Odonuo,
really?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Mm-hmm. Odonuo League, and while we all know that Giolito has an 80-grade fastball and we can find most of the scouting info on any number of sites, but when will we be able to see that player called up? I know Giolito is an easy example, but names like Mazzara, Crawford, etc. are a little more difficult to predict. Knowing when we can get ahead of the curve and can roster a player for extremely cheap gives a distinct advantage. Could you guys briefly give updated arrival dates on some of the big-name prospects who aren't right on the cusp like Corey Seager? So there's a whole list of examples here, and I will give the general disclaimer that, no, if we knew exactly when these guys were coming up, we'd make a lot of money. But what we can do is at least give educated guesses based on our understanding of these players' skill sets, where they are in their minor league progress right now, and the organizations they're in. So, Brett, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to read you these players. I want you to give me either early, mid, or late season, whatever season you decide, ETA. And then, Craig, I'm going to ask you if you think it'll be over or under. Fair enough?
I was going to pick an exact date.
Okay, you can pick an exact date, and Craig will have to go sooner or later.
For each guy? Okay.
All right. So,
sounds good.
First up is Nomar Mazzara.
Okay. June 12th, 2016.
Craig.
Later.
How much later?
September.
Okay. Raul Mondesi.
August 5th, 2016.
Craig.
Later. Way later.
Like next, like 2017 later?
Yeah, like that time, 2017.
Okay, so that's what we have our first big disagreement. Brett, Aaron Judge.
May 12th, 2016.
Craig.
Under. Earlier. Whatever.
Under earlier. Okay. Late this year or early next year?
I think there's a shot at late this year, but I'm going to say right after the Super 2 next year. So, you know, late April.
Okay. Brett, J.P. Crawford.
I'm going to say July 29th, 2016.
Craig?
I'm going to say earlier by like 3 weeks. I think he's going to be early July next year.
That's so specific.
I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if I should just agree or what.
Never agree, Craig. Never give in.
That's my motto.
Brett, Rafael Devers.
August 15th, 2017.
Oh, I thought he was going to say this year. August 15th, 2017?
Yeah.
Later. I'm going to say 2018. Okay. Sometime in 2018.
That's fair.
It's a pretty big range. Manny Margot.
Manny Margot. This is a good one. I'm going to say June 12th, 2017.
Wow. Craig.
Earlier, August 2016.
Mm-hmm. Josh Bell.
I'm going to say... How about August 1st, 2016?
I'm going to say earlier, late June, 2016.
Okay. Just long enough to be a meaningful difference. Three more?
I'm basically just saying after the... I said Super 2 before. This is after the Super 2 deadline. What I said for Judge was the extra year of control.
Yeah,
so whatever.
I was gonna wait till after. Bradley Zimmer.
Bradley Zimmer. I am going to say June 15th, 2016.
Craig.
I'm gonna say later, but just about a month.
They have such a terrible.
I think he's up the middle. Yeah, exactly. I mean, they
so terrible.
Yeah. It's sometime in that. Yeah, I think that's on the early end, but right around then is probably reasonable.
Okay. Brett, Alex Reyes.
Alex Reyes is a fun one. I am going to say
he's in Double A now.
I'm gonna say August 1st, 2016, as a reliever.
I'm going to say late May 2017.
Okay. Brett, when, if at all, do you think Reyes starts in the big leagues?
2018.
Craig? Same for you?
No, I think he'll start. I think he'll have some starts in 2017 filling in for Jaime Garcia, who will somehow be under contract, somehow be good, and definitely be injured.
That's his thing.
That's how he operates. All right. And last but not least, Nick Williams.
This one's really dependent on a bunch of different things. I'm going to say... May 12th, 2017.
Shake my head. Craig?
May 2017. I'm going to say September 2016.
I will side with Craig on that one, to no one's surprise.
I like Williams a lot. I don't think it's just going to be a straight line from here, though.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, that's all we got. That was more streamlined than I anticipated it being.
I want someone to keep track of those and tell us whether we're right or wrong.
Justin Robert.
Someone who's listening to the podcast, send us those exact dates. So then when I can brag about it.
It's either Justin Robert or I think the guy who does it for the Effectively Wild podcast. I don't think he does it for ours, but I think he listens because he's actually winning our Hack and Mass contest. But I don't know how to say your last name, John.
Chenier.
It's Chenier.
I'm pretty sure that's the way they pronounce it on Effectively Wild.
Well, shows how much I listen. Well, John, if you could also do this, I think it would be fun to look back on.
I mean, Effectively
we'll,
Wild.
We'll do it in our next podcast, which will be in 2019 or so.
Effectively Wild is pretty clearly the third place podcast on BP anyway, so I can't blame you there, Craig.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, daily? Seriously? Yeah. That's,
plus, it doesn't put me to sleep like Flags Fly Forever, so it's...
Oh, there's not. Yeah, there's not even a utility aspect to it.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, our final reader email of the week is from Cody. Cody says, is Sharkchado a good fantasy team name or a horrible one? So I'm assuming it's spelled like Sharknado, but it's a combination of Jeff Samardzija and Manny Machado, so it's Sharkchado. So I will give that a soft C, I think is what I would say. It plays better when you're not reading it out loud, like most words do for me, but especially in this case. And he asks, if it's considered good and I already have Manny Machado, and assuming I could use a starting pitcher of Sharks caliber, what level of prospect or outfielder should I give up to acquire Samardzija in a 12-team, keep 10 players forever league? Thanks, Cody. So I think the league size here is really what determines this, because you're only keeping 120 players, which means that Samardzija probably should definitely be one of the players who's kept, but he's hardly irreplaceable in a league of this size. I know he's been on a tear lately. He wasn't great earlier in the season. I would be comfortable giving up an outfield 3 or a prospect, I don't know, in the 40 to 40 plus range for him. I don't know. I know that's sort of arbitrary. Maybe 35 plus range, considering the minors have thinned out a little bit. Brett, are you particularly high or low on Samardzija? Do you think I'm in the right zone here, or what are your thoughts?
I don't think I'm that high on Samardzija, but I'd give up pretty much anyone who's not a top 5 prospect, because this is a nothing keeper league. I mean, this is pretty much anyone after Nomar Mazara.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, I'd give up. I have to look through the top 50. I don't have it in front of me. We should play some. We should have some music that plays while Brett searches for old articles.
We still need the rights to Enya. That still has to happen.
It does. This is true.
You're absolutely right. For some reason, my mind was still on two questions ago. I thought there was a minor league system in this league, but there's not. So you're right. Basically.
Okay. Yeah, everybody after Mazara. I would trade Moncada. I would trade Tim Anderson. I would trade J.P. Crawford. I'd trade all those guys for Samardzija if I needed the starting pitcher.
That's interesting. I think I might have to go one. No, it's not. You're right. Never mind. Craig?
I don't know. I'm not in on Samardzija. I'll just agree with Brett, whatever Brett says. It's the best way to go. Also, I don't like this. I don't think it's a good fantasy team name.
It's terrible.
But it's not even terrible in a way that the Madison Bumgarners was like. See, yeah, like, it's so dumb. It's funny, but Shark, because it's not even, like, do you say it Sharkchado?
I don't know, but then it doesn't have anything to do with Manny Machado, really.
Right, which is, like, this is a bad portmanteau. If you can't responsibly make a portmanteau, you just should not do it.
So the real question is this a better name combining Sharknado and a third baseman than Sharknado?
Say Sharknado. That's better.
That is better. Yeah, that is better. So I said soft C. What is your grade, Craig?
D minus.
Thanks. Brett?
F.
Wow, Dad dropping the hammer on this.
Do they even use Fs anymore?
No, they use Es because kids are raised to be pussies.
Wow.
I was going to make a more PG version of a joke that Brett made, and I don't think my life will ever be the same.
Yeah, that sounds about right. What, you think someone would name their team Shark Enya?
Back to episode 53 of Tino. I hope you used the break to recover from Brett's very aggressive dad joke. And now we are going to get into trades and call-ups. This is a little difficult for us because it's been a while since we recorded, at least in the call-up portion. So we're really only trying to hit on major guys, and ditto for trades as well. So I'm sorry if you tuned in to listen to David Murphy, David DeJesus, and Shane Victorino trade analysis. This will not be the podcast for you, but please feel free to address all complaints directly to Mal. So we'll lead off with the biggest trade of the deadline and, quite frankly, of a little while, I think. And that, of course, would be the Tulo deal. So Troy Tulowitzki and LaTroy Hawkins to the Blue Jays for Jose Reyes, Miguel Castro, Jeff Hoffman, and Jesus Tinoco to the Rockies. Rockies trading for an oft-injured shortstop and a bunch of pitchers. What could possibly go wrong? Let's start with the Toronto side of the deal first. Brett, given that Tulo was likely to be dealt from Colorado at some point in the future, how happy are you that he ended up in another very good hitter's park?
It's a good thing. I mean, it's I think the move to the American League, I think, knocks it back a tiny bit. But I think while there might be a little bit of a short-term adjustment period, you know, he's obviously a great hitter. I think he'll be fine long-term. Nothing is cores for fantasy, and we know this. I'd say this probably if he was a early second rounder this year, and nothing changes between now and the end of the season, meaning no like lingering injuries going into the season, nothing super weird. I would think that he's a late second rounder next year, and it starts to slip a little bit from there. I mean, one of my concerns with Tulowitzki about going to Toronto is, I mean, he gets the advantage of being able to DH when he's not feeling up to playing short. But the Blue Jays also have a number of guys who are going to need the DH spot every once in a while. And, I wonder how much playing on turf is going to, hurt his ability to stay, healthy, possibly more than it's already been. And that's a little scary, but yeah, there's I'd say outside of Coors, there's maybe three or four situations that are even comparable or in this range to where he could have gone here. So clearly as far as things could have gone, it's a very positive outcome.
Okay.
Craig, what do you think?
I mean, I think if he's going to go anywhere but Coors, is there a better spot for him? Maybe based on park, but not based on contextual factors like lineup and stuff like that. I mean, getting to bat with Donaldson and Bautista and Encarnacion is just ridiculous. And I mean, I could see him having more value as long as he's able to stay healthy. That's obviously the big question. I know the Blue Jays put down new turf that's supposed to be a little softer. I don't know that that's a difference maker, but I guess that's something. He's always an injury risk. I don't know that turf really makes it significantly more likely he'd get hurt either. And you could potentially say that he might not be involved in as many plays, at least to the hole, because Donaldson is an extremely good fielder. So perhaps he saves some wear and tear on actual plays that he's involved in. Like I was saying, I'm not sure there's a better situation for him in terms of contextual factors outside of Coors.
All right, Craig, let's stay with you and let's stay with shortstops. Jose Reyes went back to the Rockies. It seems, I don't know, from initial reports, like he actually might not be immediately flipped. As you pointed out in your astute tweet, their ingenious plan to boost his value at Coors Field should work because no one knows that Coors Field inflates numbers. So very sneaky by them.
Yes, very smart. Clever.
But regardless of where Reyes ends up next year, how do you view him now in sort of the grand scope of Dynasty League shortstops? You know, he's at 285, 322, 385 this year. The power is pretty much gone. He does still have 16 steals. Is he a back half of the top 10 for Dynasty League shortstops for you? Where is he now?
I guess in the near term, he'd probably be in that range. I guess, the power, like you're saying, is the one thing that's mostly missing. And that does have a reasonable chance of rebounding in Coors as long as, even if he's not going over the fence, the outfield there is so big, you can see him picking up extra bases on balls that would otherwise be singles. So if you're in an OPS league, that obviously helps. If you're not and it's just home runs, I'm not sure it's a tremendous difference maker. I don't know. at his age, he's 32 already. I guess I'd have him in the back half, but I'd be looking, I'd kind of be looking for reasons to move him out of the top 10, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
It does.
But yeah, I there's a decent chance he makes it there, but that I would probably be trying to avoid that.
Okay. Brett, how far down your top 50 does this drop Jeff Hoffman?
Pretty far.
Is he still on it?
Yes, but barely.
Okay.
And I talked a little bit about this in the article. It's, you know, it's not just about Coors Field. And, you know, I'm curious to get your guys' thoughts on this. But you know, clearly Coors Field is a terrible place for any pitcher to pitch, especially young pitchers. There have been young pitchers after young pitchers march through Coors Field and just get absolutely obliterated. The other issue is that, you know, the Rockies as a whole, as an organization, really have struggled to develop pitchers. Even before they get to Colorado. And, you know, you don't, there have been so few pitchers in their system that have the kind of stuff and upside that Hoffman has. So, you know, it's a really small sample to work with, but the track record that they've had over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years is pretty poor. And that doesn't give me any more faith that Hoffman will work out. And you know, maybe that's fair, maybe that's unfair. I mean, Craig, we were talking about this offline before. You know, it's almost like the Rockies are in sort of a no-win situation with Hoffman here, just because. Really, the only way they win is if he is an ace. And, you know, I think even the people who really like Hoffman, myself included, I think everyone understands that that's a very risky proposition. And, you know, there are many, many reasons why that probably will not happen. You know, I think he has at least a chance for it to happen, but there are lots of reasons. And, you know, I wonder how much, I wonder because of their track record, how much blame would be thrown on the Rockies for, you know, scare quote, screwing Hoffman up if he just becomes like a mid-rotation starter, or even worse, if he becomes sort of what Eddie Butler's become now. That's sort of your worst case scenario with him, but, you know, are you guys as spooked as I am? Do you feel differently about Hoffman at this point?
Yeah, I mean, John Gray messed me up. You guys know how high I was on John Gray, and I mean, obviously he's still a prospect, but he's been really not great for about two seasons, or a season and a half at least now. And I thought if any pitcher was going to be immune to the effects of the Rockies development staff and to the effects of, I mean, we don't know if he's immune to Coors Field at this point, but it doesn't look like he would be. I thought it would be Gray. So Hoffman is someone for me who, you know, in terms of pure upside with both of them coming out, I liked Gray a little more, and we've seen what's happened there. So I'm pretty much at the point where unless they represent insane values, I'm just staying away from Rockies pitching prospects altogether. There are just so many other choices that if anyone isn't close to them who I think has even nearly the comparable value, I'm just going with them in dynasty leagues. Craig?
Yeah, I don't know that I'm swearing off them altogether, but I am notably concerned, and I think it's worth, you know, this was a guy who didn't lack for risk in the first place,
yeah.
And now. You know, and that's not to say he was like, it's his fault. I think, you know, he's a guy with that command can come and go, and on a good night, he can be a 7.75 guy, and on a bad night, you know, maybe it's a 60 and 255s or a 2.6s and a 5 or something like that with iffy command, and, you know, those guys in the major leagues will get beat up, and those guys in cores can get hammered, especially, you know, if one of the off speeds isn't working. I think, you know, him not being reliant on a big curveball gives him a better chance because the sliders tend to work better. I know Dan Rosenson has been I don't know if he's published it yet, I know, but I've talked to him about it, that sliders tend to be the ideal breaking or secondary pitch for Coors. So I think that's, you know, that's something slightly in his favor. But obviously it's a negative move. And what, you know, what Brett referenced that we were talking about was that just in terms of perception, this is a guy that some people feel could be a number one or a high number two type guy. He could have gone number one overall in the draft if he hadn't gotten hurt, that type of ceiling. And there's a decent chance he's not ever going to be that guy no matter where he is. But now that he's in Colorado, when he's not that guy, it's going to look bad for them as a franchise. And that's just a tough place to be in organizationally and something I would think somewhat as a player. But lastly, I'm going to pose a question to you because someone said it to me on Twitter. They said that they went and dropped Hoffman and added Sean Manaea. And I know we're going to get to Sean Manaea later, but is it that big a drop for you?
They're close. I guess the question is whether you think Manaea ticks up with the trade. And I think we'll get there, but no. If I had Hoffman and Manaea was on the waiver wire, I would not make that move.
Right. And that's – I said the same thing, which is, again, to my point that I'm not quite to the point of swearing off Colorado pitchers. But it's – that when I think about it, do I think that Manaea can do – the Jesse Chavez thing where he's like weirdly good just because he's in Oakland? Yeah, I think I think he could. And even if I think Hoffman's better, the stats won't be quite there. Mm-hmm. So I don't think my gut reaction was no way. And then the more I think about it, the more I'm not sure about it.
See, I think I would, much for what you said. I mean, we're at the two extremes of contextual value here. Right, we have the worst park in the majors to pitch at and arguably the worst developmental staff for a young pitcher. And then you're at one of the very best parks to pitch at and an organization that just churns out successful young pitchers. So, Craig, like you said, you know, in terms of real-life value, do I think Manaea has anywhere near as much upside as Hoffman? No, but do I think the gap is so wide that the fact that Manaea is closer to the majors and is going to have a great park to pitch in, I think that makes up for it. And so I wouldn't go so far as to drop Hoffman for someone like, I don't know, Brian Johnson. But if you're asking Hoffman for someone like Manaea, I think I'd strongly consider it, yeah. He's an interesting test case. It's right. He's like right around the limit for me, I think, someone of the Manaea level of talent.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I get the argument for it. I mean, it makes sense. I don't think I could hit the button on that.
Miguel Castro, is he rosterable?
In what kind of league?
Let's say a TDGX kind of league, 20 team, relatively deep.
I could see it. I've had some pretty. I mean, I kept Mark Reynolds last year. I could see it.
He's, I mean, the thing to me is, did they announce whether they're going to start him?
No, I haven't seen anything on that.
I don't think it matters.
I don't think he can.
Yeah, I
don't think he can. I mean, there was questions on whether he could start in the first place, and then the Jays just accelerated that by making him a reliever, and I think this is like, you know, I just think it's a tough situation, and then he's in Coors, so you know, add that to it. I'd probably drop him, unless it doesn't hurt to have him. But if you can pick up someone else, I'd go ahead and do it.
You guys want to talk about LaTroy Hawkins for 20 minutes?
No. I do want to throw out one thing about this trade really quick before we move on. And I didn't get to say anything about Jose Reyes, but one of my favorite stats here is that Jose Reyes has a career 7.06 OPS at Coors Field in 116 plate appearances. It's I love when people throw out stuff like this because it's pretty much meaningless, but it's fun. He has one walk in 116 plate appearances at Coors and two home runs.
Ben, did I black out, or did you get to make your rant about home and away stats?
Like I said on Twitter, the same thing that happened to Larry Walker is going to happen to Troy Tulowitzki, where people are holding it against him that he's absurdly ridiculous at a park that inflates stats and only an all-star on the road. Like, I don't know what you want him to do. So it's just very frustrating. I tweeted out last night that, you know, making fun of Jays fans who were upset that they acquired Tulo and not a pitcher. And I said, you know, you just acquired one of the 15 or so best players of the generation. You know, you guys will probably be okay. And I got a bunch of responses about how Troy is a creation of Coors Field. And it just makes me want to hit something really hard.
Yeah, I think people don't realize, like, there's a type of player that excels in Coors and fails everywhere else. But there are plenty of people. I mean, again, like, you get your Matt Holidays who are just really good. They're just really good no matter where they are. And their home road splits are going to be weird, but while they're in Coors, but they're going to be really good outside of Coors too. So.
I feel like you were expecting a better rant from me, but that's
no,
all.
No, it's okay.
That's all the love I have to give right now.
But I do think it's relevant because I think there probably are people out there who are doing that home away split thing and getting concerned. And if that's your concern aside from, you know, and not injury with Tulowitzki, I just wouldn't worry about that.
Except if Tulowitzki only hits as he's hit on the road for the rest of his career, he's a top two fantasy shortstop for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. I think I saw someone said if he only hit what he hit on the road, he'd be like 11th all time in, I don't know what it was, OPS or one of those, like WRC plus or something like that.
Yeah, he's ridiculous.
Okay. I think we're good on the Tulo trade, yes?
Yep.
Okay. Let's move down. Let's jump over Zobrist really quick and go to Quick. No, we just talked about Manaea. We can stick with Zobrist. So Ben Zobrist was traded to the Rays, and Sean Manaea and Aaron Brooks, correct? Went back to the
Rays? To the Royals, though.
What did I say? To the Rays?
Yeah.
That's me being haunted by memories of Red Sox losses past. Yes, Zobrist to the Royals and Manaea and Brooks to the A's. What does this do for Zobrist for you? How do you guys feel about Zobrist? He still gets on base and he still hits for a decent average, but the power and speed are not super there anymore, at least in terms of homers. Craig, what say you? What are your deep thoughts?
I'm still in on Zobrist, but I think I've probably been lower on him in general than a lot of people are. I mean, I know his versatility comes in usefully, you know, throughout the season as people shift around, but it's something that I think tends to get a little overvalued in fantasy, and I've kind of tried to adjust for that and not valued him as much. I mean, his ISO is still pretty strong. It's 179 right now. That would be his best mark since 2012. I don't know. I think he's a really useful player, and he'll continue to be so. I don't know that the Royals, I mean, Kauffman is a tough place to hit. Maybe not as tough as the Coliseum, but it still is. And the A's lineup, for as bad as their record is not a bad lineup. So I don't know that it changes much contextually. And I think there's a decent chance he ends up hitting behind Alcides Escobar instead of leading off. So I don't know if that makes a worthwhile difference. But I think he's pretty much the same guy. And I think he's actually probably been better this year than we might have expected. I know, like you said, the speed isn't there, but he's also been hurt. So I don't know. I think I would expect standard Ben Zobrist from here on out. At least for 2015.
So he could indeed be the next Ben Zobrist for you.
Yeah, I think he's got Ben Zobrist like upside.
I think the fundamental skill set's there, if nothing else.
Exactly.
You don't want to label every Ben Zobrist as the next Ben Zobrist, and I think that happens a lot with guys who can play several positions, but it might be apt in this case only.
Yeah, exactly. And I like that you use the cross racial comp here.
Well, I'm just, you know, I'm trying to be
a little
progressive.
That's his forte. That's his forte.
I'm basically the Ben Zobrist of biracial comps. So, yeah. Do we have anything to add about Minaya? I feel like we sort of summed it up in terms of going to a even better park, but thoughts?
Yeah, I don't really have much. I don't think it's that much of a tick up. I mean, I think, you know, Oakland's better than Kansas City, but Kansas City's a pretty nice place to pitch too. So, and he's not going to the National League. So I think, you know, I think it's a slight tick up, but it's really nothing substantial.
Yeah.
He gets to face Houston more, and that's, I mean, potentially bad for average, but more strikeouts. Assuming
Houston never changes its lineup between now and when, which is
I think that's a pretty safe assumption.
Actually, with a lot of those players, it probably is going to be, I don't know, two-thirds the same.
Probably.
But I do think he's someone who, if you don't have him now and someone else does, I wouldn't be going and acquiring him now because he's going to get some spotlight just from being in a trade.
Yeah,
and
that's a good point.
So, like, and a value bump on that, and I think you probably missed your window, but not, you know, the next 2-3 months are probably not the time to buy.
Plus, there's always a chance Billy Beane can trade him for like DJ LeMahieu in 6 weeks anyway. So,
exactly.
Yeah. Okay. No Aaron Brooks thoughts, right? We can go to Cueto.
God, no.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Okay. So this was also probably would have been the biggest deal of the deadline had Tulowitzki not come and taken that prize for himself. But we have Johnny Cueto going from the Reds to the Royals in exchange for Brandon Finnegan, John Lamb, and Cody Reed. Craig, I'm going to stay with you because Brandon Finnegan is involved. Do you think he can be a successful starter in the National League?
I think he can be. Obviously, this is a tough park to make that, you know, to stake that claim. So I don't think it's the best news in that sense. But, you know, the National League, they said that they're going to start him. That's what they're having him do at Louisville. This is a rotation that is fairly weak and going to lose Mike Leake from either the deadline or after this year in all likelihood. So I think it's a really good opportunity for Finnegan in terms of landing spots. It's not the best environment. But, you know, that's something you'll take. There's a lot of – I mean, Reds pitchers have been useful – in Great American Ballpark. I mean, we saw Latos was really good while he was there. Cueto, obviously. I'm not, you know, Finnegan isn't necessarily at the level of those guys, but, you know, if you have a choice between him being kind of an SP5, maybe SP4 if everything works out pretty well in Cincinnati or a reliever in Kansas City, I'll take the potential starter. So I think overall it's a positive.
Brett, is John Lamb a top 150 fantasy prospect?
I think he's right on the cusp. I think because he's so close and because it's a move to the National League and a place where I think he could actually get a shot, whether it's later this year or the beginning of next year, I think it's close. I think he might be.
Yeah.
I think, you know, well, I hate to say it because he's done absolutely nothing, but, you know, the guy who I always think of as a, you know, a sort of pedestrian lefty who could be a, you know, an SP4 in Cincinnati is David Holmberg. And I think, you know, you get a lot of these guys, but I think Lamb, you know, say what you want about this, but he's a guy. He had the pedigree when he before he was hurt. He sucked for 2 years.
He was done.
And he was done. And he kept working at it and kept pushing. And there were, you know, there were a lot of people that thought that essentially his career as a potential major leaguer was over. And he's really kind of remade himself a little bit. And I think the perseverance is going to serve him well. I think there's something to that. You know, look at, you know, you don't even have to go to a different old system to see what that kind of looks like, right? Mike Montgomery was left for dead for what, 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, that's
a and now is a serviceable pitcher in Seattle. So it, you know, these guys with pedigrees that are, you know, really kind of left for it and then start pitching a little bit better. I really think it has to do with a combination of original talent and perseverance. But I like their chances of succeeding at the major league level, even if it's nowhere near the upside that we thought they might have had years ago.
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair. Also, Lamb, sort of going back to before his injury, generally had a fairly plus command profile. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. So yeah. I think that probably, you know, makes the transition a little easy and, in my eyes, perhaps a little more sustainable for him too.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay. I'm going to move us on to another lefty who's reinvented himself. How's that for a professional transition? And we will go with Scott Kazmir, who was traded from the A's to the Astros in exchange for Daniel Megden and Jacob Nottingham. Brett, I don't think we've spoken about Nottingham on the podcast at all. A bit of a pop-up prospect for our purposes this year. Why don't you inform our listeners?
I think he's pretty exciting for a guy who more or less nobody knew about coming into the season. He's a catcher. He's going to, you know, fantasy catching prospects take a little while. It's not going to be
they're
the
best. They're the best.
Yeah, we know you think they're the best. But Nottingham is a guy who could have above average hit and power tools if it works out, and that's, you know, even if he only hits on one of them, that's still plenty valuable for fantasy at the catcher spot. If he can, you know, either hit if he can either hit 20 homers or he can hit like 270 ish, you know, if he did both, obviously he'd be a stud. But I don't think. I think even if he just did one, I think he's a starting catcher in, you know, most non-shallow leagues.
Fair enough. Craig, any thoughts on Nottingham or probably not on Megden?
Yeah, I will admit to being not up to date on my Daniel Megden knowledge, including some difficulty with his last name, clearly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Nottingham, I mean, I know he's someone who was getting some play even before this trade, but this is, I mean, similar to Manaea, but on a much bigger scale. Like, this is a huge value point for Nottingham, and you're probably buying too high if you're buying right now. But he does have the skills to improve upon that. I know Wilson Caraman saw Nottingham. I think he gave him a 10-pack entry. So if you want to look for him at BP, aside from just the transaction analysis that we had on Nottingham, you can find that. I think, you know, people think he's got a chance to be a star, but kind of to Brett's point, despite my love of catchers, you know, a star catcher and overall, you know, a star catcher's overall value is significantly less than other positions. I understand, you know, relative to other catchers, it's a big deal. But in terms of overall production and then factoring in the chance he actually is that type of star, it ends up being pretty tricky. But, you know, as far as power prospects from behind the plate, he's definitely going to be way up lists at this point.
Yeah, Nottingham is essentially this year's Willy Adames, right?
Perfect comp.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, in terms of people knowing him and having there be some buzz on him and then getting blown up by a trade, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's
legit. I think that's
like
really
Adames.
Good.
I mean, Adames is a borderline top 50 prospect now, and I think if you asked me whether Nottingham was a legit potential top 50 prospect at this point next year, I'd say yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think there are probably people out there in the baseball universe who have him as a top 50 guy right now.
Sure.
And those are the aggressive people, but I don't, you know, when you get, you know, that far down a list, the gap between, you know, like 50 and 125 can be not that, you know, just based on personal preference and what you, you know, which guys you really crush on. So, yeah, I think that's a really apt comparison in terms of from a value standpoint.
Okay. Let's do a real quick touch on the trade that impacted three closers or potential closers, which is Papelbon going from the Phillies to the Nationals with Nick Pivetta going back. I don't think we have to talk about Pivetta today, but we can talk about both Ken Giles and Drew Storen, who were impacted by this deal. Why does everyone think Papelbon is bad, Craig?
I don't know. I was talking about this with Mark Normandin, and it's really weird. It's just obviously like the Chapmans and Kimbrels and Jansons of the world get kind of a step above, like a pedestal over other closers. But Papelbon has been amazing this year. He doesn't have the strikeouts to match up with those guys, but he's been legitimately phenomenal. And putting him on the Nationals, I mean, Brett, would you have him outside your top seven for the rest of the season?
Papelbon? No, he's easily a top 10 closer.
Okay. I mean, I think, and you could easily push him into that kind of top seven range if you want, you know, after the quartet of like Holland, Jansen, Kimbrel, and Chapman, in my opinion. I understand other guys are maybe more exciting, but I just feel like in my head, once he left Boston and got like closer money from Philly, everyone was like, LOL, he's not worth the money, so he's not good. But he's actually been probably worth the money, and, you know, I don't know. It's just a bizarre situation to me.
It's a weird case where I think, like you said, someone's contract and the fact that he's an asshat have actually bled into his fantasy value.
Yeah. Yes, that's – you said what I said, except you said it in six words, and I said it in 1,000, including – a mispronounced word.
That's fine. That's how it happens. Ken Giles, top 15 closer next year? Brett.
Borderline, yeah. I think just inside. I wrote up in the transaction analysis that just went up. I think he goes sort of into that same category as AJ Ramos and Carson Smith. Mm-hmm. Guys with pretty high strikeout rates, guys who are really really good pitchers. Giles might strike out a couple more guys than that, but he's probably also looking at fewer save opportunities, realistically. So I think he's right in that range, like somewhere in the 13 to 16 range.
Yeah, that seems fair. Drew Storen, sucks to suck. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, that just sucks.
He's really good.
He's impressive. I mean, he's to me a top 10 guy prior to this. Do you think he's? What odds do you put on him being a National next year, like opening day next year?
I mean, what leverage does he have to force himself out other than pouting? Really, I think it's pretty good, honestly.
Yeah, I'd say about 90%, 95%. I don't see him going anywhere.
I mean, these monster bullpens are becoming all the fad, and the Nationals are basically building one, so why would they give up Storen unless they're getting something pretty impressive back?
And they've done this before. So.
Yes, they have done this before. To Drew Storen.
I feel so bad for Drew Storen.
Womp womp.
Going back to Brett's point on Ken Giles, just really quickly, I think – you know, he was all the rage as a sleeper, like closer speculative play. And the names that you said, Brett, Carson Smith, and AJ Ramos, are exactly why you don't make closer spec plays that far in advance.
Yep.
Like they're just as good as he is, and they came from basically nowhere. It's not that they don't have any pedigree or that they weren't good, but no one had, you know, had them in line for closing duties before the season necessarily, and they've been incredible. And it's just to me a reinforcement that you don't waste a roster spot on these guys well in advance.
Yeah, except for Keith Cromer, who has been touting Carson Smith since January.
Well, that's why you read BP.
Yes, he gets mad props for that one.
No, but he totally does. He totally does.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to do a lightning round with the three major call-ups we have to discuss, because if we go any longer than this, we'll tire ourselves out and won't record again until September. So first, let's go with Miguel Sano. We have not talked about him since he's been called up. 74 plate appearances, 283, 405, 517, striking out over a third of the time, does already have three home runs. Brett, is Miguel Sano going to get Joey Gallo'd, or is he up for good this year and will he produce?
Oh, he's up for good, and he's real. He's going to have his struggles like any prospect, especially one who has some contact issues to start. But I think he's had a really strong approach at the plate. I think he's up, and I think he's up for good.
Correct.
Yep, I agree, and it's something that not all that long ago, I think I asked everyone while we were doing some sort of game whether we preferred Miguel Sano to Joey Gallo, and at the time we all took Sano. I think it was a game where we were buying shares in each in different players, and I think that probably still looks pretty good at this point. I think his success, like Brett said, is sustainable. He hits the ball really damn hard. And so he's not going to have like a 400 BABIP forever, but he's also, I don't think he's going to strike out at 35% forever either. And he's shown an ability to, wait on his pitch. So I'd be extremely encouraged. I had someone text me yesterday asking if they should trade Sano for Corey Seager.
That's interesting.
That's a tough question.
That is interesting.
I don't
that's
know what
really
to,
tough.
And that should let you know how highly this isn't just like an early dominance thing or anything like that. Like
it's not a fling. It's real.
Right. Exactly. It's real. And I think I think you could make a case that Miguel Sano, were he not in the majors, is right up there with Seager, possibly the number one prospect in terms of fantasy. Or I guess if you're ranking Seager as number one, I'm not sure. But I think Sano is comparable, if not better, value.
All right. Aaron Nola, 330 ERA, 7.9 K per 9 in 13 innings so far. Looks pretty good. Obviously skyrocketed through the minor leagues. Craig, we'll stick with you. Is Aaron Nola a reasonable number four starter in 12-team leagues next year?
Yeah. I'm totally comfortable with that. I think he's a guy who is what he is from the get-go, and I think there's some room for growth if he wants to, if he can improve his sequencing or tighten up command of certain pitches. His command overall is quite good and helps his pitches play out, but I think they can come and go on his breaking ball right now, and I think that can get better. So I don't think he's stuck as what he is, but I think his floor is pretty locked in, and I think he's kind of there right now. So I'm completely comfortable with that.
Brett, if you had Cole Hamels and were selling him in a fantasy league, would Aaron Nola be a good headliner for you?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, moving on. Michael Conforto up with the Mets. Apparently, I missed the part where Michael Conforto was the best prospect since Bryce Harper, but I suppose being that starved for offense will do things to you. How are you feeling about this, Brett? You feeling good? You happy?
He's like a mirage in the desert. I mean, that's really what this is at this point. I am happy. The Mets have trotted out some pretty shitty offensive players. So I may not be the biggest Conforto fan in the world, but even if he's not ready, he still might be an upgrade over what they could have done. So, short of a trade or, I don't know. I'd rather have Conforto out there right now than Kelly Johnson in left field. I mean, that's kind of a disaster.
Fair enough. Craig, is Conforto going to get more than 400 plate appearances next year?
Yeah. I don't know. God, I mean, I guess Kadir's there. Yeah, I don't see a situation where they can reasonably hold him down. Of course, reasonable isn't really a bar the Mets meet a lot. So
true.
I guess that's not a useful statement, but yes.
All right. Does. Brett, most likely to be moved in the next 3 days. Cole Hamels, David Price, or Enya? Welcome back to episode 53 of Tino. As always, we're going to send you out with a little housekeeping. Courtesy of Justin Robert, we have updated Tino Hacking Math standings through July 27th. First place, Joe Schlobotnik All-Stars, followed by Bud Black Sabbath, basically the Phillies, the Junior Lake All-Stars, A Hot Dog Is Not a Sandwich, Rusny Trombones, Mao, Not Mr. Tibbs, you picked a fine time to leave me, you seal, and Hacking Mass is a sandwich. The most important takeaway there, Craig is in last place. Please rate and review us on iTunes, since we only record once or twice every few months now. Shouldn't be that hard. You can follow this podcast on Twitter at Tino Podcast and get in touch with us through email at tinopodcast@gmail.com. You can find Brett at Dynasty Guru. You can find Mao at mrubio52. We miss you, Mao. You can find Craig at CD. That's CD as in continual diatribist Goldstein. And you can find me at Ben Carsley. Thank you for listening and have a good night.
See, I wouldn't be able to say
it. Okay, just because you said, what did you say, PD stool?
I said pedestal.
Oh, you a stool.
Yeah, I don't.